Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, it's Sunday. That means it's a live edition of The Main Course. Of course, if you've downloaded it, I guess it's a repeat. But we have a special honoree Hall of Fame engineer in-house today.
Wow.
And producer. Hey, Jack, how's it going?
I'm good. Thanks for the intro.
So what's transpired in all these months since you've been in studio on a Sunday? You've been working quite a lot in the headquarters in the Hive.
The Hive, yeah, I like that as the name for
the local Hive.
Yeah, along with Aaron, you know, things are moving fast. We've got tons of new projects. We had a very successful salon party that you were at last night with none other than Mark Ladner.
Yes, I was most amazed at that event. I mean, besides how delicious the sandwiches are, that he invented and had designed for him this little 50 skewer rotisserie. It was like a Lilliputian rotisserie thing, and you could literally make 50 sandwiches all at once just with these little rotating things. And all the heat came out of a little, what was it, like a little air tube, right? And
yeah.
We stuck it out the front door, and it is basically a no-smoke process.
It was great. I mean, kind of like a fast food bite, you know?
How many people showed up?
I would say probably around 75 or so throughout the course of the night, which was nice for that space.
Yeah, and how much money did you raise? Did you reach your goals? Because, as of course everyone knows, Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit 501c3 organization. So,
absolutely.
Did you guys raise?
I must say, a membership drive in May. So once May starts, ooh, that's, you know,
well, May is also when you're doing your next event. So we want to thank Mark Ladner and Del Posto for coming in and really launching our salon series with a big name like that. If people have not been to Del Posto, it's, among other things, the first ever four-star non-Japanese, French,
that's
or
right,
American restaurant ever. So, you know,
and
that's
as
a
Mitchell
high
Davis
honor
says, the lunch at Del Posto is the best value move in New York City.
Oh, very interesting. Well, it looks like someone's fishing for a free meal. So tell us about your Hawaiian Underground party.
Yeah.
That's a big event.
That,
I mean, that has
huge.
Delaney Barbecue, Heritage Foods USA, Untitled, Maysville, Court Street Grocers, Roberta's Catering, Gramercy Tavern, Brooklyn Grange.
Oh, yeah.
Empire Brewing, Amphora. Which is what, a beer as well? Or
Amphora is the beverage company behind the Joe Campanelli's restaurant, so they'll be providing some wine.
And music by DJ Reaganomics.
Reaganomics, you know, we figure for a liberal food event, we'll get some Reaganomics in there.
So how's that event play out? Like, what's what would people experience if they showed up to it, which is May 19th?
May 19th, that's right. It's a Sunday, and it's a whole pig roast in the backyard of Roberta's with, you know, there'll be a campfire there, there'll be, as you said, music and food and an auction with incredible food art items and other surprises. I mean, this is like the big one that you want to go to.
Where are you getting the pig from?
That's I believe you guys
know. Heritage Foods, yeah. I hope.
What pig is it going to be? Can you disclose that?
Well, I don't know what coming in that week. It's probably one of Lazy Ranch's red bottles. We're going to talk, we have our only guest for today. You know, whenever he comes into studio, we only have one guest. It's like, you know, Bette Midler and Robin Williams were for Johnny Carson. When they came on, those were the only people that got their thing. They would always have some comic at the end that they would list at the beginning, but they would inevitably bump him. So, we're going to be talking to Zach Kell, the chef of a very important restaurant in New York City called Community Food and Drink, which is on the Upper West Side. So he'll be on. But as you know, I like Sunday mornings, you know, people wake up, they've been out late. So I always like to do my introduction on Sunday mornings to kind of put people back into that sleep mode. But I have been reading for this book that I'm writing all these books about, you know, things that I didn't know enough about to write about. And one of the chapters is a hero's chapter. So the heroes in the book are Prince Charles is one. Temple Grandin, the animal rights activist, is another. And Ted Turner. I just knew I had to put this guy as one of my top five because as the largest landowner in the United States, he is actually one of the reasons he wanted to become the biggest landowner was to recreate the traditional migration lines of the bison in the American West. It's still amazing that even someone could do such a thing in this day and age, but he's successfully done it. And I'm reading this book called Call Me Ted. And, you know, it's been very reassuring almost to read that book because, you know, when I left Slow Food to start Heritage Foods, which, you know, sells 200 pigs a week and turkeys, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And then when we put these two shipping containers here for the radio, you know, we weren't sure if we could pay for it or how it would work or anything, but we just went. And, you know, sometimes you feel like the world's caving in on you, but when you read a guy like Ted Turner's life, you're like, oh my God, that guy was working on a much bigger level. He just started with like a little billboard company, Jack, if you can believe that. His father gave him a billboard company and they would pay about $25 a month to thousands of businesses throughout regions that they had the rights to put billboards up and they would advertise for things.
Is this in Atlanta?
Yep. It was based in Atlanta and in the South. His father was a very tough guy, but you know, the billboard company, you know, which, you know, was involved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different people with different properties. And they'd be like, hey, you're in a really key curve of the highway. You own that land. Can we put a billboard up there for $25? And they would build the billboard and they'd need to know how to place it. So, you know, because they were a billboard company, it was important that they be part of the community and that they give to the local charity. So, I mean, they were really great community people throughout the South through the lens of this billboard company. So he takes that, he starts a radio station. I mean, he buys a radio station, an existing one. From there, he buys a TV, a station, which, you know, has a few weird shows. And but, you know, he was in TV. He didn't care. Then he took advantage of that satellite moment, you know, and all of a sudden he created the fourth network, the Superstation. And he relied on a little spot on the satellite he got. I mean, this guy owned the Atlanta Braves, which was a big thing in the major leagues because they did not like that he had a national team and that you could watch Braves games in Pittsburgh or New York or Seattle. I mean, you know, he was a really brazen guy. He sued CBS, NBC, and ABC in an antitrust suit, and he bought MGM Studios in Hollywood. Anyway, he's a fascinating guy, and I haven't gotten to the end of the book, but I mean, the guy goes on to become the largest landowner, and he was just a brash guy who would like get on his hands and knees at board meetings and being like, please, I'm begging you, I really want this, please. And no one could take his vote against him because he was just a charming guy and he was larger than life. And you know, I most admire him, of course, from the food thing. The guy started a chain of bison restaurants around the country. I mean, like, I think his goal was 500. He might have gotten to 280 or something, or 300, but that is impressive. I mean, the guy gave the bison a raison d'etre again here in the U.S. So Ted Turner, weird guy, crazy guy, but definitely commands respect. So wow. I recommend that book, Call Me Ted. We'll take a short break.
Hey, I have two questions
for you. Oh, yeah, yeah. Fire away, Jack.
A, can we have Ted Turner on the show sometime?
It's nice to know someone was listening, by the way. yes, I think he would be an evolutionary.
Yeah.
Well, describe evolutionaries for our listeners. And if Ted is listening, maybe he'll agree once he hears you explain what
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. Yeah, Evolutionaries is about a 25-minute series. Each episode is about 25 minutes, produced by Aaron Fairbanks and me. And we interview the leaders who have changed the way we eat in this country, and not only just in food, you know, even outside of that. And we edit down their story into a radio documentary that's very produced, and there's music and narration, and it's just a great way to get to learn how some of these people changed the world of food. So
these are big people interviewed.
Steve
Jenkins was your first because he was one of the first guys to introduce cheeses from Europe and olive oils from Europe
and
into
then,
the United States.
Mr. Food Science himself, Harold McGee, on week two. And now coming up next, we have Eric Repair, who I'm sure your listeners know of, the guy behind Le Bernardin. And tons more. Florence Fabricant, Marion Nessel, Wiley Dufresne, the Mondavi family, Jim Leahy, Joan Dygussow, Patrick Martins.
Mm.
Yeah.
Not familiar, but that is a very, very impressive list. Thanks for including me in that.
Yeah.
Checks in the mail. And what was your other question?
Will you ever buy a sports team?
Will I ever buy a sports team? No, but I will say I'm very happy. Actually, you know, I skipped over this because it wouldn't have made sense at the time. 100%, I guarantee it, spread it on the airwaves, we're going to get into television. We have to. There's got to be one guy out there that would find value in having cameras follow around the various tentacles of HRN between Dave Arnold and Katie Kiefer and Mike Edison and Heritage and what you do, Jack, and even our friend Tony Butler at Bread and Life. I think it would be, you know, maybe without the crazy drama that everyone thinks is necessary in reality television, but there'd be a lot of fascinating stuff behind the scenes at restaurants and this and that. Don't you think it could work, Jack?
Absolutely. You heard it here first.
We just have to find someone simpatico. So just as you and Aaron are like, we're trying to wrap our heads around radio. But trust me, TV will help radio. I guarantee it. So, no, very exciting. As for a sports team, I don't know. Do season tickets to the Nets count?
That's the first step, I think.
Yeah, I could see Jay-Z through normal without using a device. So that's pretty good.
There you go.
All right, brother. Well, we will come right back with my friend Zach Kell. Stay tuned to the main course.
And you're listening to Mad as Dogs by The Hollows on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Well, very nice. So I am here with Zach Kell. Welcome, Zach.
Thank you.
I only have two things on this outline, trip and tripping. So... And actually tripping meaning two different things, because we will not mention the blueberry pie episode, although that would have made, or four, five berry pie. Remember the five berry pie at the goods?
Oh, the crumble. Yeah, yeah. We don't talk about that.
We don't talk about that. So we just took a trip together for 4 days. We were in a group of about 10 people, and we drove around all these awesome heritage farms in Kansas. So I know this isn't a real question, but what were some of your thoughts and impressions from seeing some of Midwest's heritage breed farmers?
Well, you know, I'm from the Midwest originally, so I grew up around a lot of that stuff. But I think really the biggest thing that happened to me on the trip was just kind of like being reinvented and re-inspired into cooking and being in the restaurant. Because farm to table is like a big buzzword kind of thing that happens in a lot of restaurants right now. Mm-hmm. But it's rare that I think you actually meet anybody in those restaurants that has actually been to the farm to see the pig, you know. And we try to do as local as possible, but there are certain things that are just easier to produce in the Midwest, and it's nice to go there and actually see that they're doing things properly and, you know, meet the pigs and see how they're being treated and where they're coming from and really have a connection, you know. Like, people can come into my place now and ask the servers about the food, and they'll be like, yeah, we have someone on staff who has been to that farm. Mm-hmm. And it's actually inspired me to kind of continue that and go visit a lot okay. more of the farms in New York that we buy from as well. You know?
Cool. Now, where did you grow up in the Midwest, and were you closer connected to your food being in the Midwest, or were you...
I mean, that was the 80s, so not particularly close or connected, mm-hmm. but I was, I'm from Indiana, southern mm-hmm. Indiana, and I grew up, you know, in the middle of nowhere on a gravel road, and there were cows and horses and corn growing across mm-hmm. the street, and we did do some purchasing at, like, the local farmers markets and stuff, and we grew a lot of our own vegetables in the summer and things like that, but, you know, the bulk of the proteins was all coming from the local super grocery store.
Yeah. You know. Well, we'll come back to the trip throughout the interview, but I mean, so where, what other purveyors do you guys keep in touch with on a close level through your restaurant? Because I know you're part of a group, right? There's a Clinton Street Bakery.
Yeah. I mean, they're group. Not, I wouldn't call them a group.
Oh, I see.
There are Neil and Dee Dee Kleinberg, Neil Kleinberg and Dee Dee Lahman own Clinton Street Baking Company, and they also own Community, but with a third partner.
Okay.
So they're the creative side. So as far as creatively goes, they're mm-hmm. very similar between the two restaurants, but financially they're totally separate.
They're totally separate.
Yeah.
Well, Community is a very interesting place, just to contextualize it. I mean, it's on 112th.
Yeah.
And Broadway. And it's right next to Columbia University. So in a lot of different cities around the country, like where it's a very small town in the South, but it has a university, Community Food and Juice could be that restaurant, you know?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Yet it's in Manhattan with a billion other restaurants, and it maintains such a high level of sourcing because it has this whole university and education support behind it. So I'm very interested who you source from and what does your menu like look like besides the meats?
Well, we try to keep it a little healthier because they're, you know, being at a university, you have a more health conscious crowd, and it's refined, but not to a point of being overly contrived, you know, being that we are actually like a true farm to table restaurant, and we do use a lot of really high quality products. We don't need to put a whole lot into them. Mm-hmm. You know, you just got to be able to execute them properly to bring out the natural flavors because they're just delicious as they are. But I do a lot of work with the Union Square Market, Lincoln Center Markets.
Well, you go to Union Square every Wednesday, right? You have to
Wednesday,
get there
yeah.
early and get the best stuff yeah. before it sells out.
Yeah. They set stuff aside for me, so I can kind of take my time with when I show up. But
you
I,
are charismatic. You can get yeah. there a few trips, and then it's reserved.
Well, you know, once you build that relationship, people know you're coming, then they pull it aside. Or, you know, I can even give them my order a week in advance or whatever and pick up, like...
Just for people who did, radio is not a visual thing, but Zach is a little bit Kevin Bacon, a little bit James Dean. You know, he's maybe got some
Christmas
Paul
Slater,
Newman or something in there. He's a definite energy. Certainly, they'd remember you when you came back the next week.
Yeah,
they'd be like, yeah. "All right, that's a guy from uptown."
I have two main people that I buy from at Union Square. Lynn Haven, it's a goat milk creamery, so okay. we get all of our goat cheese and all of our fetas, goat's milk feta, we buy from her. I have a standing order with her. I get, like, you know, 40 pounds a week or something.
What do you do with all that goat milk?
Well, we don't actually use the goat milk. The goat's milk we buy from Bat and Kill.
Oh,
have you ever heard of them?
Yes, I have.
Lynn Haven, I just get the cheese from, and that goes in everything. I mean, as you know, Community does a large amount of brunch and breakfast business. So the goat's cheese and the feta cheese goes in omelets and scrambles. We use it in a lot of salads, you know, on both the lunch and the dinner menu. I also buy a large amount of produce from Migliarelli Farms.
Okay.
And from Blooming Hill Farms. Mm-hmm. Samuscott Orchards we use. Satter Farms right out on Long Island.
Yeah.
We use them a lot for a lot of stuff. Who else? You
do
guys.
You like the stuff that you buy here? I mean, were you also a chef in Indiana? I forget.
I was, and again, this was like in the late 90s. So it was
things
kind
were
of,
different.
Yeah, it was actually, you know, I started there and I came here for a couple years, and I was back in Indiana for a year right at the time when slow food was first developed in, like, what was that, 2000 or 2001?
That's right.
Or something. I was a member for a little bit there, and it was interesting to go back after coming to New York, doing culinary school, spending like a year in the field here, and then going back and seeing slow food and seeing restaurants there kind of trying to change and cope. But it was...
with the times.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, it was a totally different world, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, hey, this is what we should be doing. This all makes a lot of sense. And we're in the middle of farm country. Yeah. Like, why aren't we
eating
from
fast
these guys?
Food, yeah.
Yeah, totally. You know, everything's coming from Cisco. Who knows where that's, you know.
All our good stuff is being shipped out.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is like third world, too. You know, these great countries in Africa and stuff are producing, like, boysenberries for America. It's crazy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, stuff like that does have a big effect. And when we were back, me and my fiance, maybe 2 years ago.
Who's here, but... not talking.
Yes. We went to a place that I had helped open maybe 6 years ago, and we had a meal there for, I think it was New Year's, and it was actually one of the best meals I think I've ever had in my life in, you know, Bloomington, Indiana, which is, you know, is a college town, just like kind of the sectioned off Morningside Heights in Manhattan. You can kind of get lost up there and forget that you're in New York.
Exactly. It's nice. It's like a little island.
But yeah, it's good to see, you know, a southern Indiana town being able to produce high-quality food that's actually being produced locally, you know, and taking advantage of that.
So when we took this trip, we went basically to a slaughterhouse for a day. Then we drove to Salina. Well, we went to that Cozy and Burger place, but we visited Frankie. Sorry,
where
that just shows you where my mind is.
72 burgers. I just... want everyone to know that. 72 burgers. That's how many he bought.
When we bought, they're very tiny. They're in the image of White Castle. But it was so funny. That poor guy was overwhelmed when we walked in.
Oh, yeah.
Before we walked in.
Well, we weren't the only ones ordering 72 burgers.
No.
You know, it was like everybody
like
in line
trucker.
Was like, I'll take 65, you know.
What was most crazy is that they kept the drive-through window open when it was just still that same dude.
Yeah, yeah, there was just those two guys, right? It was like those two guys, and they both did 7 days a week, and that guy had owned the place for like 20 years or something.
Yeah.
They were still cooking on the same griddle that was 96 years old.
It had been there from the beginning. I mean, the burgers still, I mean, you, for $6.95, you get 30, I mean, you get some crazy number of burgers. I forget what each one cost.
I think it was like $4.50, you get six burgers and a soda and chips or something.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. Little hole in the wall, but out and covered in all the media attention that they had gotten over the past century. But so, I mean, then we went, we visited a heritage poultry farm where that guy has like dozens of breeds of chicken and poultry. We visited
who is a practicing anesthesiologist. That's a very interesting point about him.
Yes, exactly. He's used to injecting things with needles, but all of his, just for the record, all of his chickens are naturally mating. They're not artificially inseminated. Then we visited a couple pig guys and a lamb guy. Did you find anything unusual about the pork or the lamb or the poultry, maybe that you didn't know before or that have informed your kind of view on proteins?
I mean, the pork farms are all pretty much what I'm used to from Indiana. And it doesn't seem unusual because most of the production out there is small too. It's to be like, you know, our neighbors had 10 pigs, and so even smaller than what we saw,
right?
But they weren't producing for, you know, to make money. It was like their pigs, you know?
Right? Home pig, kill it in the winter,
exactly.
Eat it through March,
exactly. But it's, you know, it's all very wholesome stuff. So I think that the unusual thing for me would be to visit like one of the mass producing indoor farms or something like that. But I like really the most eye opening thing was the poultry farm and kind of like that as being a basis or a jump off for what a lot of these guys are doing. Especially the fact that's why I wanted to mention that he was an anesthesiologist. So having a medical background, he has, you know, a pretty serious like ethical training and bringing those ethics into what he's doing as far as raising poultry goes and seeing those same ethics reflected in what a lot of the pig farms are doing just as far as like doing no harm first and trying to breed for a healthy animal and giving your animals the best life that they can have and all that kind of stuff, which is really what it should all be about, you know?
Yeah, because when you need anesthesiology or any injection, something's wrong.
Yeah.
And that's what's amazing about the big farms. They preemptively put medicine in the feet. I mean, before it even starts.
Exactly. I mean, and stuff like with Craig Good, we actually saw him give an injection to a piglet, but it was clearly like the piglet had an infection, and you know, if you wanted to save its life, then it needed something. And that's what I'm talking about with like ethical use of these things. Like, you have medicine and there's a reason for it, but if you're just pumping it, you know, into these animals because you know otherwise they're going to die before you can make money off of them, it's poor ethics. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, what bothers you most about the big farms? Like, having grown up in Indiana and then you see these heritage farms and you support all these local farms that are doing things the right way. Is it the animal rights? Is it the taste? Is it the medicine in the feed? Like, well, what gets your gut as a chef? Because everyone has to rely on it.
The flavor definitely is night and day between the stuff that we get from you and the stuff that you buy, even at the good grocery stores like Westside Market. You know, actually, right after I got back, I did a couple of classes for the staff at the restaurant where I kind of just went over the farms and the outline of the trip and everything. And then I took our pork chops that you bring in and I cooked them. And then I went to the store, Westside. Yeah, Westside Market. It's like a block down and across the street. It's actually a really good grocery market. Store. Yeah, they're
meat
great.
Is a different, it's a part of a market. It's not the whole thing.
Yeah, and they have, you know, organic stuff and all this. And I just bought the same cut of meat, of pig, and I showed it to everybody raw. And you can, like, you just looking at it, it's night and day. You know, the heritage stuff is well marbled and it has a darker color. And the flesh is a different texture when you poke it. It's a little softer. And then the stuff from the market, it's just straight pink all the way through, you know, and a lot of that's just product marketing too, is pork being marketed as a lean product. So the big farms, they breed all the fat out of it, you know.
Now, you can't avoid processed food. I mean, I had a turkey sandwich yesterday from a turkey that suffered in a big factory farm.
Sure, absolutely.
What is your goal? I mean, as a chef, as someone who's so closely related to food, when you're not in the restaurant, and you're, you know, how do you eat? Are you all crazy and like, oh, I will not eat this, it is not local, or how does it work?
I eat pretty horribly when I'm not in the restaurant. Yeah.
Almost as a reaction to the fact that you're working with all these pristine ingredients.
Honestly, when I cook at home, it's usually product that I'm working with at the restaurant.
Okay.
Right? Because it is, it's really the best quality stuff that I can get to. I buy from the same farmers that I buy for the restaurant, you know. But when I'm not at home, when I'm running around, I mean, you know, I eat a lot of pizza and crap out of the box, and we do a lot of Chinese takeout and stuff. But it's New York, you know.
They have to keep those delivery guys in action. I always think they cook. They come so fast, the Chinese delivery thing. I always think they cook it in the bike.
They pedal to keep the
basket hot.
But it's, you know, it's a little different. If I wasn't in the restaurant, I would definitely have a different attitude towards what I ate and cooked at home. But knowing, you know, that I can, especially during the busy season like now, that I can really provide like a large order to a small farm, you know, like I'm, you know, Lynn Haven, for example, they rely on their markets to be able to continue to do what they do. But, you know, an entire day's worth of market business, I don't know what she's selling, but, you know, might be $1,000 in sales or something. And I can come in there every Wednesday and give her $450, you know, and know that that's really putting a base underneath what she's doing and helping support that, you know, just like the same way you never would have been able to get off your feet without the Batali support. So, you know, knowing that I'm doing that, and that's directly my decision because I don't have to buy from her and I don't have to buy from you, is a good peace of mind, you know.
Yeah. Now, let me ask about these chefs that buy commodity either because they have to or because they don't get it or whatever. I mean, it is an interesting and would be a cool almost challenge to make average-tasting stuff taste spectacular. I mean, from the perspective of the chef, is a chef like, oh, let me just shepherd through this piece of agriculture to the plate, like a la Alice Waters? Or is it like, oh, I will make even a rotten piece of fish taste like a four-star fish? Or, I mean, where's that line drawn between where you come in and where you don't, you know, in your personal cooking style?
Well, I mean, a lot of that stuff, like if you have, you know, I mean, rotten, obviously, if it's rotten, it's disgusting. And you're not going to eat it. But generally, you're just dealing, like when you get the commodity stuff, there's less flavor inherent in what you're buying, right? It's just more bland. because there's less fat in it, because of the diet, because of the exercise, you know, it's just bland. So you have to add a lot more to it to get big flavors, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a fine line.
So
like,
you'll
you
put
know,
more, I mean, not to say that you guys
seasonings
ever use,
are different
yeah,
things.
At home, if you were to have a commodity, you know, you're in yeah. Indiana and you go to the Costco and you pick something up, you'll add more to it to try to help it.
Yeah, to yeah. try to jump the flavors up, you know. Mm. You might do brines or marinades or stuff like that, but the you know, the Berkshire's like you don't need to do anything. It's fresh, you cut it and throw it on the grill with salt and pepper, it's delicious, you know. But you know, the more bland you get, the more you have to put into it. Not to say, you know, that you wouldn't want to use a good quality of pork for something that's inherently a spicy food like a curry or something like that, you know, even, you know, curry with bland pork is going to be not as good as curry with amazing pork.
Even
you
with
know?
It, yeah, for sure.
But yeah, definitely, you know, and there's certain, it's a philosophy thing too, because this is still a new movement and there's still a lot of people that don't know about it or really mm-hmm. understand what it is or understand the difference in the quality of the products.
Or they might have heard it about the movement, but they don't get it.
Yeah. So it's not the kind of thing where it's the standard and accepted, you know? So it's easy for restaurants to get away with using commodity products and not having it be a detrimental thing, you know?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you said something very true because they just had Steve Jenkins as the first evolutionary, and he was the first, arguably, but very close to the first guy to bring not even domestic cheeses, but European cheeses here, and that was in 1981. I mean, that's not that far along. So we are going to take a short break and come right back for our final segment with Zach Kell. We are sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons.
And this one's called Burgundy, also by The Hollows, on heritageradionetwork.org. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, Jack, you know, we always say HRN is not quite, you know, where it needs to be at the level of NPR in terms of listeners, but there are certain advantages of a very small listenership. I think we have one listener. Hey, Mom, call me at 1 o'clock. I need to come over and pick up some of that old olive oil that you have been aging, all right? All right, I'll be there in a bit. All right. Well, we're back. We are with Zach Kell, the chef of Community Food and Juice, and we are talking about a farm trip that he took to, along with three other chefs and a couple of people from Heritage, to meet some of the people who had been providing him the proteins for the main courses at his restaurant. And it was a very fun trip. We visited pig farms and lamb farms, and they even this was mostly in Kansas. They even had those kind of hunting or what do you call herding dogs from Babe.
Yeah, not border from collies. Babe,
border
yeah,
collies.
Yeah.
Those were impressive the way they really keep cool. those. I have actually a picture of all these like whatever sheep and goats I guess they were herding, and then there's like this weird little mini horse.
Yeah, little Sebastian.
little Sebastian.
Yeah, the miniature horse.
The little temperamental scared horse.
Patrick, what farms were these? Who were some of the farmers?
Well, you've met, and it's funny, you've met all the Heritage people. You've met Larry and Madonna Sorrell.
Yeah.
Amy and Craig Good, who came to your first fundraising party.
They did.
And then Frank Reese, of course, the mythological Frank Reese. He's kind of like a Jesus Christ of sorts. I mean, you drive onto his property, everything looks plain going up there or not spectacular, and then he's this like heavy presence, because also what he holds on that farm is...
Yeah, that was really an incredible place. I mean, what does he have now, over like 200 different breeds of poultry?
Yeah, just between the chickens and the turkeys and the crosses, and he keeps them all separated. I mean,
Whole idea of what he does, going around and finding near extinct breeds and then bringing them back and mm-hmm. breeding them into enough to make it actually a sustainable line mm-hmm. again. Like it's
reading old poultry books and meeting with other experts to determine which breeder is the best one. I mean, that's got to be the most important farm in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. It's huge. I mean,
it's a museum,
especially when you talk about the poultry industry and that being the worst as far as commodities going, and really like healthy chickens disappearing from the face of the planet. And what he's really shepherding, you know, he's trying to save something that's dying.
Yeah. And he's saving incredible. 30 things. I mean, let me say it. I do not give a shit if Joel Salatin's chickens shit the yard and then the cow takes a piss and then he grows the corn and that it's all cycling in. Everyone talks about that guy, Joel Salatin. But let me say once and for all, Frank Reese is the most important farm in the country because he's doing something beyond just turning a profit. That guy is the last bastion.
He actually, in fact, is not in it for profit.
Yes, you know? He wants to become a nonprofit. I mean, he makes his money selling his turkeys, but for the chickens and the ducks and the geese and the this and the that, he is really trying to leave America better than it was, you know, when he was born.
Yeah.
And that's GoodShepherdPoultryRanch.com.
Yes, well, it's really HeritageFoodsUSA.com. We'll edit that out. Mom, stop. Do not go to the computer and log on to that website. No, just kidding. Well, we did go to Manhattan, Kansas, the Little Apple, as they call it, on this trip. And things got...
Was it fake St. Patty's Day? Or fake St. Patty's Day was the week before, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. This was fake. Or some, it didn't seem fake. I mean, we were, despite military guards with like rifles,
presence, yeah, large military presence
outside of almost every bar. I mean, it was crazy. I didn't get that. That is a buzzkill. I mean, I hope they realize that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there was actually a large military base that's very close to the town. So, but it was strange to walk into a college town bar strip and see the local police standing next to not even like reserve or a National Guard, but just like straight up army dudes with M16s on the street at like 2 a.m. Yeah, in fatigues. You
and
know,
then
hanging
you're getting
out in the police
into a
station,
car.
Like,
I mean, not drunk. We had a designated driver.
Yeah, we had a designated driver.
Thank God for Catherine.
Yeah.
She's like, I can do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really, Sam Edwards was kind of the thing that worried me the most about walking around the town intoxicated.
Sam Edwards. Sam Edwards, of course, is the sponsor of today's show and the owner of an 82-year-old curing ham business. And well, I thought we would lose him as a customer when I humped a cutout cardboard poster of Ronald Reagan.
And then rubbed it on your butt.
Yeah, I rubbed it on my butt. That's what it was. I was not very honorable. But although they they reacted to it very well at that Republican enclave. Oh, yeah. I thought I would get my ass kicked.
Yeah, I know, especially since as soon as we walked into the bar, there was a line of people waiting to have their picture taken with it.
I know. Well, not after I got my butt in there. Now, you almost got into a little tiff, if I recall, with Lane, a certain farmhand from Good Farm, and a certain pool player, right?
Or no, not Lane. Yeah, this was Sam Edwards.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So Sam and Steven wanted to play pool.
Steven is the chef of Farmstead Restaurant in Napa Valley. Yeah. Although maybe edit that out if the story turns.
Well, so unbeknownst to me, you know, I'm hanging out and we're drinking at a table, and Sam and Steven wanted to play pool, but there were two guys on the pool table that were both very intoxicated.
on the pool table.
Yeah. And so I'm actually a certified instructor in two different forms of martial arts. I've been speaking to Sam about this earlier on. And so they wanted to play pool. So Sam, I guess, I found all this out later, uh-huh. had gone to the guys at the pool table and told them that I was going to get into a fight with them. Right? And got them kind of riled up.
Sam is 60 years old, by the way. He's not like 12.
And then he went to the bouncer and told the bouncer that the guys at the pool table were talking shit and they were going to try to get into a fight with me.
Oh, my God.
And then came and told me, right, that they were going to jump me somewhere outside the bar. So then this is all over the period of about 20 minutes. So then I went to the bouncer and I was like, listen, I've told those guys over there are pissed at me for some reason and they're going to try to fight me. And I just want you to know about it, because if they physically assault me, I'm going to really hurt them. Yeah. And I don't want to have to do that. And he's like, well, if anybody gets in a fight, you're all going out the door. And I'm like, listen, man, I'm going to do everything I can to stop this from happening. But if it does happen, you know, just keep your eyes on them, because I can't go anywhere near them. So the bouncer now being approached by two different people. And seeing this guy, I didn't know that Sam went to the bouncer yet.
This is the most Manhattan
fight
of all time. Nothing's actually happened.
Nothing at all, right? So the bouncer sees these guys at the pool table. I turn around after that, and I go back to my beer, and I turn back around, and the bouncer's escorting these guys out of the bar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Sam and Steven are, you know, putting their money in the pool table to set up their game.
That was all for them.
So it was all Sam, like, orchestrating this whole thing to get these dudes thrown out so he could play pool.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, you are a criminal mastermind.
Yeah, see, he could be a military general in any armed force initiative. That is impressive.
It was really incredible. That's why. And then you remember at the gas station, he invited those drunk girls to get in the van, and we'd give them a ride. And I'm like, Sam, what are you doing, man?
We're not
military
taking them to the
everywhere.
Goods.
What are you doing?
What would Amy Good say? Who are these three women in my bed? But, oh my God, that is hilarious. It was, it was kind of crazy. I mean, it's almost like, there were these huge bars. I mean, each bar, you would go one huge bar, and then there'd be another back room with a huge bar again. And like,
well, it should
space.
Be mentioned that it was... This was the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day.
Little St. Patty's Day.
Yeah, which in Kansas, I guess it was Kansas State University there, right? Mm-hmm. Is spring break is just ending on that weekend. So when we were there, it was actually fairly quiet.
I see.
Right? Because everybody was out of town. Mm. But it was still the day before St. Patty's Day, so everybody who was still in town was out. Otherwise, I imagine it would have been like kind of a ghost town.
Yeah, it would have been a little bit more. Now, and you shot guns. Were you a good shooter? I forget. Stephen Barber was a very good shooter.
Yeah, Stephen Barber surprised everybody.
Yeah.
I was mediocre, you know. And then the girls, like, what usually happens when you put a gun in a girl's hand, they're always like, no, I don't want to shoot a gun. But then they turn out to be incredible shots. They all, like, hit everything.
Or they shoot themselves, one of the two.
Yeah.
That's happened with a couple. No, but no, girls are usually very good. They're good at free throws and shooting, I've noticed.
Nice
girls.
Joke.
Is that true, Jack?
Free throws, yeah.
I mean, girls are always – I've never beaten a girl in a free throw competition, and I'm a pretty good basketball player. But that was it was definitely a great trip, and those people are amazing people. I recommend everybody. Manhattan, Kansas, Little Manhattan. They've got microbreweries there. We didn't really get to go to the restaurants. But what about that party that the lamb guy threw us in that gorgeous barn with the cows in the basement?
in the event space. He was the son of like a big farmer, right?
Yeah, you could tell they were just doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Now you've gotten his lamb since.
I have. And it's good. I actually just tried the merguez samples. Did you get those from
Lou Fantasma in an effort to move more lamb? Of course, I've said this before on the station. Everyone talks about nose to tail, but most Americans aren't looking to eat a hoof or a shank or something, you know, but ground meat and hamburger meat or sausages and things of that sort, everyone loves. So it's a very ingenious way to move more pounds for a farmer is if you can make a good ground product. So Lou tried a couple merguez. I mean, we thought they were a little mealy maybe for a first try, but it was a very solid first effort, and I think maybe we got to go one more whack at it or two.
Yeah, I think
a
slightly different grinding process and, and definitely more fat.
More fat.
Yeah, I think some of that, you know, you want it to be all lamb, but he gets all that great fat back in. He needs to, like,
throw a little
push
pork
a little,
in there.
Yeah, a little fat back in there would be
really
good.
Jews and Muslims. But, yeah. This merguez is not for you.
Hey, generally when you're making sausages, more fat better?
I'm not sure.
To a certain extent. I mean, the same thing with hamburger, you know. There's always a different grind. I think the Shake Shack burgers are like a 60-40.
Really?
Maybe, or maybe a 70-30.
That's pretty fatty.
Which is, yeah. But that's why they're so good, you know.
So that's 70% or 60% lean and 40% fat.
Yeah. Or fatty beef, you know. But it depends. I, you know, the thing is, the way that that guy raises his lambs, they're very lean. You know, they run around and they're free range, and you know, they don't eat a lot of grain, and that these are all like contributing factors to the meat that you actually get off of the animal. So if they're just grinding his animal straight, they are going to be a little lean. But the thing
That's
is that the fat content, Jack, really has to do with how dry the sausage is when you cook it. Less fat means that more moisture is going to escape, and you're going to have like more product that's going to kind of suck moisture out of your mouth when you eat it, which gives you that dry thing. Fat coats the inside of your mouth, which keeps the moisture intact. So if you have a lower fat content, you're going to get like kind of a drier, mealier thing instead of like the tender, juicy ground product, you know.
Well, you know, Jason, who was also on the trip, it was Jason and Matt from the Batali and Bastianich Vegas restaurants, he actually took a picture of the lamb he gets and the katahdin, and he noticed that the fat cap was very little for those same reasons. So I called Hubbard, and now he's going to process next time he brings in, next month, a different breed, a fattier breed, because he sees he has to overcome the kind of free range. I mean, that's the problem with grass-fed too, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's a reason why
grass-fed beef, I mean.
Yeah, there are specific breeds of beef that handle it well, like the Piedmontese, you know, because they're bred to be a fattier animal. So you can still grass feed them and free range them and everything, but they still maintain the proper amount of marbleization.
And a burger, you have a lot more freedom to put more fat in it, whereas with the steak, that steak is just the steak.
I mean. I mean, you know, anytime you grind anything, you can put whatever you want in it.
Right.
But the steak is just, it's a solid piece of meat. You can lard them and stuff, but that's, you know.
Now, the merguez, isn't it supposed to be a little bit more shriveled? I mean, it's not, is it usually the, I've always seen them like in, when I would live in France or whatever, they were these other sausages that like looked
like
different.
The cured
yeah.
product? Yeah.
Yeah.
You can have them both ways. There's a fresh and a cured, just like chorizo.
Okay.
You know, you can get the fresh Mexican chorizo. It comes in casings and everything, but usually they cut it open and then fry it kind of like ground beef or ground pork, which is what it is. But you can also have like an air cured chorizo. Same thing with merguez, or really any sausage, you know.
Well, this has been a great show. We've gone over by 4 minutes, but we think Zach's restaurant is a great one. We really recommend for people who come. It's you know, for people who are like, oh, I don't want to go to some crazy place that's, you know, all wild, and you're from another part of the country. That place is going to be consistent. And for New Yorkers, it is a very pleasant surprise. You get a sampling of antipasta sauces and dips, and you got honest hamburgers, and you got a lot of healthy foods like salads. What is it? It's an Asian salad, right? That you...
Yeah, the rice bowls.
Rice bowls, big seller. Yes. Rice bowls. So we're big fans, and you're going to be hearing as much of Zach as he's willing to give when he comes back onto the station. Thanks for being a guest.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, great job.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Congratulations on all your success and all the events and all the post-produced pieces. Stay tuned for Straight No Chaser.
Go Knicks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.